TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Dr. Larry Brilliant. Outbreaks are inevitable. Pandemics are optional. In the spring of 2017, at a release party for his book, Sometimes Brilliant, he sketched out the extraordinary voyage from civil rights movement to med school to helping out as physician during the occupation of Alcatraz by the Indians of all tribes. In the Bay Area, Larry Brilliant connected with the psychedelic and music counterculture. He followed the hippie trail from London over the Khyber Pass to India with his wife Elaine, Wavy Gravy, and the Hog Farm Commune. Neem Karoli Baba, one of India's best-known spiritual teachers, told him his destiny was to work for the World Health Organization to help eradicate smallpox. Larry Brilliant became a key participant in eliminating that 10,000-year-old disease that killed 500 million people in the 20th century alone. Smallpox was declared eradicated in 1980. This is a 3-minute clip recorded in March 2017. Larry Brilliant is predicting the deadly mistakes that were made from January 2020 on when the corona pandemic began.
There's sort of a mixed story about pandemics. You know Ebola and Zika, MERS and SARS, Lassa fever, swine flu, bird flu. There's been more animal viruses jumping from animals to humans in the last 30 years than we have records of before. And that's worrisome. But much more worrisome than that is that the institutions that normally keep us safe are sort of AWOL. In the Ebola outbreak, Obama sent 3,500 American soldiers to West Africa. We spent billions of dollars because WHO failed in its job to protect us because it took 6 months to correctly identify what the disease was that was killing people in West Africa. So WHO is going to have a new director general in May, and I think it's going to go through a period of self-examination, and it's offline. And I think this presidency, as far as pandemics, is offline. You're not going to see public health, let alone pandemic preparedness, at the top of the priority list for this White House. And they fired the head of CDC, and Trump is cutting the budget for public health and pandemic preparedness. So if you look at those agencies that normally keep us safe, the federal government, WHO, the UN, CDC, they're all offline. We have to have a safety net to protect us, to stop pandemics, to end the threat of pandemics. April 7th is World Health Day. It is also the 100th anniversary of the great influenza, the Spanish influenza, the 1917 to 1918 pandemic. One of my grandparents died in that. One of Gurdjieff's grandparents died in that. I wonder how many other people know that in your genealogy, some of your relatives died from that, because somewhere between 25 million and 100 million people died in that 1 year period. And if you put that to today's numbers, you're talking about 75 to 300 million. If we had a pandemic 1/10 of that, 1/100 of that, it would bring humanity to its knees. There wouldn't be an airplane in the sky for 6 months. Who's going to get on a cargo boat with 300 people whose epidemiological status you don't know, when there's no vaccine and no antiviral? I want us to stop the risk of pandemics. We know every step to take. We know how to do it. There will inevitably be outbreaks. There'll be viruses jumping from animals to humans. Outbreaks are inevitable, but pandemics are optional. We don't have to have them if we have the same public will to end them that we had to eradicate smallpox. And that's what I'm hoping that we can pull off next.
That was Dr. Larry Brilliant, recorded in 2017. Now he sought out for advice on the corona pandemic by media and organizations. On March 24, 2020, he was interviewed by Dr. Daniel Kraft, Chair for Medicine, Singularity University. Here's Larry Brilliant.
So my job today is to spend about 10 minutes, no more, telling you about the entire history of pandemics, at least in the last 100 years, covering everyone in fine detail, and then talking to you a little bit about how this pandemic, COVID-19, how it falls into the spectrum of other diseases like it. Let me start off by saying we are living in an age of pandemics. Not only have we had 6 major global epidemics over the last 100 years, century, but every year, 2 or 3 novel viruses spill over, jump species, jump from animals, jump to humans. And those viruses, the 50 or so that have jumped in the last 30 years, have created many diseases that are recognizable to you, many others whose names you've never heard. A couple of examples: SARS and MERS, bird flu, swine flu, West Nile, Zika, dengue, chikungunya. Why have we entered into an age of pandemics? In part, it's because it's always been like that. There have always been novel viruses jumping from animals to humans. Even a lot of the diseases that we consider endemic, like HIV/AIDS and smallpox, before it was eradicated, were originally animal viruses. But now, in the age of modernity, humans and animals are living in each other's territory more and more. We're cutting down the rainforest. Those animals must go somewhere. Humans have pushed, expanded our territory to the edge of forests, to the edge of jungles. We're living closer and closer with animals that we've never integrated our lives before in history, never so much. We not only have more viruses jumping from animals to humans, but now, of course, when they jump, we're there ready with an airplane to help take them all over the world right away. There have been 4 influenza pandemics in the last 100 years. In 1918, we had a pandemic of an influenza virus that was called H1N1. And I apologize, but all of these viruses are named by the neuraminidase and hemagglutinin that they have in the virus. H1N1 is also called swine flu. It was given the unfortunate name of the Spanish flu, although the Spaniards were the ones who behaved well. Every other country was at war during the First World War. And military censorship made countries lie and suppress their disease so they didn't appear their army was weak. Spain was neutral. And when a member of the royal family came down with the disease, it was only natural. In a bout of radical transparency, the Spanish announced that they had this disease in their borders, and forever we awarded their good behavior with giving them the name, which we try not to use anymore. We call it the Great Influenza. Great because it went around the world 4 times in 1 year before there were cruise ships or jet planes, and it infected 1/3 of the population of the world. 1 out of every 3 people of the 2.5 billion then alive contracted this disease, and somewhere between 30 and 100 million people died. Why such a large range? Well, because nobody was counting the deaths in much of Africa, much of China at that time, so we're guessing. In 1957, during the summer of love, going into 1958, we had another pandemic, influenza. This one was caused by H2N2, and it caused 1 million deaths. 1 million deaths compared to 30 to 100 million deaths, but still 1 million deaths. In 1968, an influenza H3N2, which was called the Asian flu, rattled the stock markets, rattled the global markets, created massive disruption, and killed 1 million people. And then in 2008, our old friend swine flu, H1N1, came back again, and this time it infected one third of humanity at a time that our population was over 6 billion people. Probably more people were infected by that virus in that time than any other virus in that short a period of time in human history. So four pandemics that were influenza. In fact, some people think of a pandemic almost exclusively as influenza. It is interesting that we don't count seasonal influenza, which every year kills between 300 and 500,000 people. But there are other diseases which, if not pandemics, are pandemic-like. Let's for now call them endemic global diseases. Of course, HIV/AIDS, it's a pandemic to me, but we don't like to think of it in the same way as a rapidly moving influenza pandemic because it moves so slowly. Instead of an incubation period of 1 to 4 days, it might have an incubation period of 6 months. Nonetheless, over 30 million people have died from HIV/AIDS in every country in the world. I think it qualifies in every other way as a pandemic. And of course, I would be derelict in my duty if I didn't mention smallpox. From 1900 to 1980, smallpox killed between 300 million and 500 million. Now that's not a wordo. I really do mean half a billion people. In fact, smallpox was probably the most lethal disease in human history for an infectious disease. But in 1980, the World Health Assembly declared that we had eradicated smallpox. When we talk later on, I will tell you why I'm an optimist. But the major reason I'm an optimist is that I got to see the last case of smallpox on Earth. A little girl named Rahima Banu, Barishal District, Bola Island in Bangladesh. And when her smallpox lesions fell off of her body and were cooked by the hot sun of Bangladesh, that was the end of a chain of transmission, probably the worst disease in history, stretching back to Pharaoh Ramses V. And if we can eradicate smallpox, I'm confident we can do anything. And that includes COVID. So COVID-19, really COV2, COV2, is the third coronavirus. It's not an influenza virus. The third coronavirus that we have had global epidemics in the last 20 years. In fact, in 2002, we had a SARS outbreak. We had about 7,500 cases and 1,000 deaths. And then we had a MERS epidemic. SARS was a bat disease that undoubtedly infected an intermediary animal. MERS is a disease that stays mostly in camels, but somehow it got exported and got exported into Korea and Thailand. And there were 2,500 cases and 900 deaths. That's a huge case fatality rate. It's a frightening disease. Now we have the third coronavirus. That's why this virus is called COV2. And that's the name of the virus, but the name of the outbreak, the epidemic, is called COVID-19. So what about this particular pandemic? Where does it fit in the rogues gallery of pandemics? This disease is moving very fast. It has a replication value, this inherent number that tells you how many secondary cases are being infected by a primary case, of somewhere between 2.5 and 3.5. Every case gives rise to 2.5 or 3.5 more. And since there is exponential growth, that's the exponent. And you can imagine if you give this virus a 3-month head start, you're going to be dealing with tens or hundreds of millions of cases very quickly. We're lucky in that this is not only the age of pandemics, it's the age of technology. So we, for the first time in history, are dealing with a pandemic that we have the tools to conquer. We will more speedily than ever get a vaccine. I'm confident that we will have a vaccine. It may take us 12 to 18 months, but we will have a good vaccine. I'm confident we'll have an antiviral. It'll be faster than the vaccine. I'm confident that that antiviral will work as a therapeutic antiviral. I'm hopeful that it will have vaccine-like characteristics, that it not only cure cases of COVID-19, but prevent others. Now, if that sounds a little strange to you, think about HIV/AIDS. When we first found that it was a death sentence, we thought that it was going to be 100% fatal. Then we developed antiretroviral drugs. Case fatality rate began to drop. It became a disease that you lived with, not died from. Then some very clever scientists reorganized the antiretroviral cocktail, and they found that they could create a preventative antiviral, an antiviral with vaccine-like properties because it could prevent the disease for an individual. So let me leave you with one more thought before I open this up to questions. After the 2008 swine flu pandemic, even though it infected a third of humanity and killed almost a million people, I think some people looked at it like some people are looking now at COVID-19 and said, have we overreacted? We had not overreacted then. We are not overreacting now. But so concerned were a bunch of epidemiologists that people thought we overreacted to swine flu because although it infected a lot of people, it didn't kill so many people. But we were worried that people had forgotten what the pandemic of 1918 or 1957 or 1968 looked like. So my friend Jeff Skoll became the executive producer on a movie. I was the science advisor, and that movie was called Contagion. A lot of people are watching it right now. Some people are telling their children not to watch it because it'll frighten them. I understand that. It has some frightening elements to it. But that virus that we created, which was a little bit of a Nipah virus, a little of a Hanta virus, and mix in a little parainfluenza, that virus is fiction. That virus was much worse than COVID-19. We must keep that fictional virus fiction. We, for the first time in history, have a chance to battle a pandemic with new tools, a new attitude, a new optimism. We must stay optimistic because let the fictional viruses stay in fiction. Let the historical pandemics stay on the dustbin of history, and let's work together to end COVID-19 as fast as we can. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Larry. You're truly a global treasure, humanitarian and beyond. Couple quick questions. I heard you on CNN last night talking about containment and mitigation. What kind of guidance would you give on the containment mitigation side right now?
Will you give me a time machine? Because if you would, I would go back 4 months and I would flood the zone with tests. The U.S. has now done almost as many tests as we have cases of COVID-19. South Korea did almost 300,000 tests for a population much smaller than the United States, we've done 1/10 the number of tests. We have been irresponsible in the way in which CDC, my beloved CDC, where I trained and I love dearly, CDC fumbled the ball on creating a test that could get out into the public very quickly. And our government has let us down. Instead of finding a way to have tests so that people could have a pregnancy-like test at home, a pinprick, a little bit of blood, a quick test, a little blue dot that says that you have COVID, a little pink dot that says that you don't have it. If we had that test and it was everywhere, then we could behave rationally. We could find the areas that were still susceptible to finding cases and then going all in on suppression, which we used to call containment, by quarantining everybody. Nobody gets out of the house. You lock down that area. But that idea of quarantining and locking down, that's the wrong strategy for places where there is either a great deal of disease and so much community transmission that you're not going to accomplish very much, or no disease. So we need to go back to the drawing board. We need to follow the virus and put the epidemiological tools that we have to place where they will do the most good. So to me, it's not a question of, are we going to do mitigation or are we going to do containment and suppression? We have to do both.
Are there any sort of tools that we should put into the hands of government or public health officials locally that really could change the game? I mean, we're sort of late, as you said. We don't have a time machine, so we are what we are. What would be in your magic bottle right now if we could pull it out of our hats?
So there's good news and bad news. The bad news is we will not stop this pandemic by social distancing, by any of the steps that we're taking right now. When we try to flatten the curve, bring it down, it isn't in order to reduce the total number of cases that we'll have. Think of your calculus. By moving the curve way two steps to the right, the area under the curve doesn't necessarily change. So why are we doing it? If we're going to have the same number of cases, we do it because we don't want more deaths. Because the deaths that we will have if we have a huge spike that paralyzes all hospitals, the deaths we'll have will be from a heart attack. There'll be trauma deaths that will get to an emergency room and not be allowed in. There'll be people trying to get chemotherapy for their cancer and not have a place to go. We have a lot of deaths and a lot of sick people every year all over the world. If we don't preserve our health system so we can take care of them, that yes, maybe we won't be reducing the number of cases of COVID, but if we don't flatten that curve, we will increase the number of deaths. And that's what we can't do. As doctors, as public health people, our obligation is to reduce human suffering, reduce deaths.
And you learned a lot from your work in India with smallpox. Part of the challenges in healthcare is all these silos and folks not often collaborating. We eventually want to have on our smartphones that immediate viral detection center that can be pan virus. What might you suggest as we move into the future, as you've done with Skoll Foundation and beyond, to really set the platform for the next pandemic so we have early prevention and response?
Well, we have on our smartphones, and we have what's called Flu Near You in the United States, Flu Tracker in Europe and in Australia. And this is an opt-in bi-directional system. You can get it on the web and look at Flu Near You, and you can see that you have an opportunity to sign up that once a week you'll be asked, are you have a cough? Do you have a fever? Do you have chest pain? Are you sneezing? Have any other feelings, any aches or pains? By doing that, you can screen for both influenza and also for COVID, because the symptoms early on are so similar. It'll be launched this weekend with the help of two big technology companies and the CDC. And when it's launched, we hope that everybody will opt in and allow their data to be shared anonymously so that the spot maps will accurately reflect where the disease is. I hope long-term, honestly, we have a stochastic sample, a random sample, and a probability sample, our country, every country, our states, so that we can watch in real time as we create a tracking poll of the virus using incidence, not cumulative prevalence, just incidence. Watch it every day, every week. That's when we'll be able to be smarter about what resources we put in what place.
And it's almost like I mentioned earlier in my section, we almost need that kind of Google Maps or Waze. We're all sort of donating data, hopefully anonymously, and we kind of get those early alerts and build that map around us, like Flu Near You or the new one, COVID Near Me, I think .com or .org, which will allow you to anyone to opt in and get a picture and contribute to that map. So we have that early insight.
That's right. And take a look at Health Map, by the way, which is at Harvard, at Beth Israel Hospital, that John Brownstein has been working on for a very long time. Take a look at that, because on that map, which looks a lot like Google Earth, you can see all the diseases in the world, all the infectious diseases in the world, and what country they are in, and watch as they move from place to place. Not as a voyeur, but to be able to understand, you know, what diseases are coming up and what we need to do as a society to deal with them.
A lot of folks are now physically distancing, some socially distancing. Many folks are not biotech folks or data folks. Any kind of guidance, maybe even from the spiritual realm, you've gone through an amazing spiritual journey with the Grateful Dead and beyond, that could help people through this time. I mean, it takes a village and it takes new mindsets, and you may have some guidance there.
I think of the Grateful Dead song, sometimes the light's all shining on me, other times I can barely see. I think that each of us should think about our community and the most vulnerable people in our community, the homeless. Some of us are going out and binge shopping and hoarding. Homeless people cannot binge shop and hoard. Please give money to your food bank. I've watched to see a lot of younger people volunteer with their masks on and their gloves on, socially distancing themselves, bring food to elderly people who are locked up and leave the food in a bag outside of their room. We can make this into something that isn't so much of a psychological burden by helping others. The best way that we can help ourselves is to reach out around and work with the rest of the people in our community. Those who are in America, every county in America has a VOAD, which is a voluntary group that works and puts together all the agencies and all the nonprofits in your county that are working on a disaster. Find a way to volunteer. You can volunteer from home. There are a lot of people who need to be called. They're lonely. There's things that we can do. Don't give up. Don't become a couch potato. Become an activist, even though you have to do it maybe virtually. Maybe there's something to that word virtual.
So just to finish up in the last few minutes, like, so now we have the chance to sort of connect these dots. You know, you've crossed many different fields from, you know, Silicon Valley to CDC to ashrams. You know, how do we connect these dots faster? And what might, if we wanted to push ahead, let's say to 2025, what kind of world do you think we could create? Because we're going to enter a brave new world after this. It's going to be world 2.0. And maybe your vision of how we're going to set our pandemic response engine.
Well, I'm a scientist, but I'm also a person of faith. And I believe that in times like this, we have an opportunity to be the best version of ourselves that we can possibly be. And that's the world that I want to see, where each of us finds the best person that we can be, and we live that life. I see a world of more community. Maybe it's virtual for quite a while, but there's no reason that it can't be loving. It can't be intimate in the way you can in a virtual streaming world. I'm not disheartened by spending 4 weeks, 6 weeks, whatever the time is, at home. I think of it as a enforced meditation retreat, if we can do that. And it's a time to study, reach out to friends who are lonely and alone, and give them your love and your help. It isn't just the science. It isn't just the innovation of the technology. We need to be human. The virus likes us because we're human. We like ourselves and have to find a way to be the best human beings that we can be.
That was Dr. Larry Brilliant, interviewed by Dr. Daniel Kraft, Singularity University. Brilliant currently serves as the chairman for the Advisory Board for Ending Pandemics. He also works with the charitable organizations launched by the major technology corporations, such as Google and the Skoll Group. He's board certified in preventive medicine and lived in India for more than a decade, working as a United Nations medical officer. He played a key role in the successful WHO campaign to eradicate smallpox in South Asia. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.